John Bachman, who pierces people's face. The K is for the kill, L is for the lover, and the M is for the mutiny, and I wish it didn't happen.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my drum?
Now the N is for knots, oh no, my bones are sinking. The B is for the peg leg that keeps me standing up. A Q is for quantum leap, R is for the rum, and the S is for the scurvy, which I wish I didn't get.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg.
That's underneath my boat. And B is for Mukitas, who plays a sour note. W is Tiasis, X marks a spot. Why? Cause I'm a pirate.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my grog?
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. Repeat, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Monday, March 5th, 2012. Youth critically injured as Israeli troops attack commemoration protest in Central West Bank, while 21 civilians arrested by Israel's military. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Nineteen-year-old Mohammed Abu Awad was critically injured on Monday by Israeli troops when they opened fire at a group of Palestinian youth conducting commemoration protests near the central West Bank city of Ramallah. The protest was organized near the entrance of the Israeli settlement of Ofer near Ramallah. The youth were commemorating the second anniversary of the death of five members of Abu Awad family. The family members died after their car was hit by an Israeli military jeep at the gate of the Ofer settlement. Witnesses said that troops fired tear gas and rubber-coated steel bullets at the unarmed protesters. A tear gas bomb hit one youth, Muhammad, in the head. Dr. Ahmed Al-Bitawi, head of the Ramallah Medical Center, told reporters that Muhammad sustained critical wounds in his head and was admitted into surgery. In other news, three relatives of Palestinian political detainees were arrested by Israeli soldiers on Sunday during a jail visit, the Palestinian Prisoner Society reported on Monday. According to the report, the incident took place at Rimonim Military Detention Facility. The Prisoners' Society announced that troops stormed the visitors' area and arrested 26-year-old Dalia Matar and her 15-year-old brother Saeed. They were visiting their brother Muhammad, who is currently serving a life sentence after being detained since 2003 by the Israeli military. 30-year-old Yusra Kaddan was also arrested by the Israeli soldiers while she was visiting her brother Saeed. Saeed has been detained by the Israeli military since 2003 and is currently serving a 25-year sentence. The arrested visitors were taken to unknown location by the Israeli troops. The Palestinian Prisoner Society also reported that troops cancelled all visiting on Sunday for the rest of the prisoners and their families. Meanwhile, on Monday morning, Israeli forces invaded West Bank communities and arrested 19 Palestinian civilians, including five children. The five children were arrested by Israeli soldiers after they raided homes in the Silwan neighborhood in East Jerusalem. Other invasions and arrests were reported in the cities of Bethlehem, Ramallah, Nablus, and Qalqilya. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Monday, March 5th Daily News Roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. Join us again tomorrow for more news and updates. Please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by Hussam Kassis and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
On the 4th of March, APEC, the American-Israeli Political Action Committee, began their annual convention in Washington, D.C. One of their first speakers was U.S. President Barack Obama, who gave one of the worst speeches in his entire career, bluntly threatening Iran with war after saying there had been too much talk of war. His speech was broadcast over the public address system to protesters outside.
We are not what we want.
A deliberate effort to sustain our coalition and ensure that
the Iran's program is monitored. We are diplomacy, not weapons.
Opposes
friction sanctions. We do not want any of those weapons.
It is a military
a
effort
of Iran
to be prepared for any
people
contingency.
Of Iraq and
After Obama's motorcade left the Washington Convention Center, running a gauntlet of protesters to do so, many people had something to say about the president's bluster and threats towards Iran. Here are three speakers from directly in front of the Washington Convention Center, two from a Jewish perspective but anti-war and anti-Zionist, and one from the perspective of a military veteran.
Make me ashamed of being a Jew. And I don't being a Jew. I want Jews to stand up for real values, which are love, compassion, generosity, living in peace with our neighbors. Those are real Jewish values. Do you hear me in APAC?
I come here today again as a Jewish American. I come here wrapped in a tallit, in a talis, in tefillin, which for those who don't know is a commandment to wrap yourselves in the Torah and justice, and that's why I'm here today. And I have a message for everyone in APAC, everyone walking into APAC, who says that they represent America and Jews and the people of Israel. The reality is that the majority of the people of Israel oppose your occupation. They oppose war in Iran. Jews in America oppose the occupation. They oppose war in Iran. Americans oppose the occupation. They oppose war in Iran.
Yes.
And those Jews of us who stand here today, who stand across America, across the world, in Israel, in Palestine, we are secular, we are religious, we are veterans and objectors to the IDF, we are people who want nothing to do with any of that. I have been through the West Bank. I have friends across Gaza and the West Bank. Many Jews who stand here today, who stand in Israel, who stand across the world, have seen the atrocities that this occupation has done. They've seen the way that it has stolen democracy from their country as well. I doubt that many of those walking into there, those who wear kippahs, those who claim to speak for Jewish interests, have seen the reality of the occupation, have seen the reality of their crimes. And I come here today to say that I believe that the Torah and Judaism teach me no justice, no peace. 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 No justice, no peace.
War is not the answer. Know that war solves nothing except killing innocent people and making money for the war machine. And we've been lied into wars. We've been lied into wars with Afghanistan and Iraq. We do not want to be lied into another war with Iran, another war of choice. We say no. We say no to war, and we will not fight another illegal, immoral war of choice where innocent people will die. This is absolutely critical that we speak with one voice, we stand on the side of peace, and we say no war on Iran. The people of Iran don't want war. The people of Israel don't want war. The people of the United States don't want war. The only people that want war is the military-industrial complex and the politicians. And we say no, no to war, no to war on Iran. We will not fight another war of choice. Peace to Iran, peace to the Palestinians, peace to the world, peace to the powerful and power to the peaceful.
It was just 9 years ago that George W. Bush lied us into war with Iraq, talking jive about weapons of mass destruction that were never found and were never there. Now, just 9 years after the start of the war in Iraq, almost exactly 9 years after to be exact, President Barack Obama wants to do the exact same thing to Iran using the exact same lie. What gives? They think we're gonna buy this junk about curveball and yellow cake and weapons of mass destruction not once but twice? They think we're gonna believe their lies a second time around for a whole nother war? They and APAC have got another thing coming.
I believe it is essential when we see a threat, we deal with those threats before they become imminent. The world.
Afghanistan, last Thursday, two American soldiers were killed in an attack on their base in Kandahar. There was a good chance this attack was provoked by the Quran burning incident. If so, that raises the U.S. death toll stemming from that incident to 6. Unfortunately, none of these 6 Americans were the ones responsible for this hate crime. Afghanistan, ongoing. 5 U.S. soldiers have been identified as being responsible for the burning and desecration of multiple copies of the Quran at Bagram Air Base. If guilty, the appropriate charges would be felony inciting the riot and at least 32 counts of felony murder based on the at least 6 American soldiers and at least 26 Afghans who died in fighting resulting from their conduct. There's no way this could possibly be an accident. I can't imagine anybody being that stupid in Afghanistan and having enough brains to find their way from the bar to the army recruiter. Haditha, Iraq, today. More than 30 armed fighters dressed as police SWAT teams opened fire on police checkpoints all over the city, killing 27 cops. Only 3 of the attackers were killed in the resulting fighting. The attack began with 14 SUVs carrying the attackers entering the city with forged arrest warrants for senior police officials. At the first checkpoint, they ordered all officers to turn their cell phones off, then opened fire. This was repeated at the Haditha police station. It was quite a while before police even began to suspect anything, and when police finally did begin to fight back, they were only able to kill 3 of the attackers. The rest got away clean, even recovering the bodies of 2 of the 3 of their dead. So much for all that garbage about how the U.S. war in Iraq stabilized the country. Mr. Barack Obama, you can't stabilize Afghanistan either. Now's the time to bring the troops home. You sure as hell can't beat Iran, a nation triple the size of Iraq, so stop trying to sell us another war with the exact same excuse about weapons of mass destruction that George W. Bush used to lie us into war in Iraq. The GOP primaries for the 2012 presidential election are beginning to take on an ugly sectarian undertone. We've got violently anti-gay and anti-birth control activist Rick Santorum attacking Barack Obama, a sitting president, for being the wrong kind of Christian. The only other country I know of where this kind of sectarian religious attack is being made on a head of state or any member of his cabinet is Iraq, where Prime Minister Maliki, a Shiite, is trying to have the Sunni vice president arrested. If the 2012 election in the U.S. turns on sectarian issues, both GOP frontrunners will have a problem. The last Catholic U.S. president was Kennedy, but he did not need a single vote from GOP Southern fundamentalist Protestant Christians to get elected. Mitt Romney, a Mormon, would be rejected by a lot of Southern Baptists and other so-called evangelicals as not being a Christian at all, while Santorum, being a Catholic, would have to overcome bigotry by some fundamentalist Protestants that regard the Catholic Bible as satanic or worse. Maybe that's why Santorum is campaigning so aggressively on anti-women and anti-birth control issues, so beloved of the religious right, to get ahead of the sectarian problem? If so, I don't know what the elephant in the room is smoking. Some kind of hashish, I suppose. But I do not want to hit on it, and I hope to God it goes out before November. This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to wsqtradio@hushmail.com. Repeat, wsqtradio@hushmail.com.
With the U.S. economy in the worst shape since the Great Depression, economic issues were an obvious focus for debate among the presidential candidates in this year's election campaign. But in recent weeks, Republican candidates running for the White House have veered toward issues favored by the Christian right that include opposition to abortion and gay marriage. But what's been a surprise to many observers is the recent attention to the long-settled issue of women's access to contraception, which has not been seriously debated in U.S. politics since the Supreme Court settled the landmark Griswold v. Connecticut case in 1965, in which the justices ruled that the U.S. Constitution protected a right to privacy, overturning a Connecticut law that banned the use of contraceptives. With the exception of Representative Ron Paul, GOP candidates Rick Santorum, Mitt Romney, and Newt Gingrich have all to some degree challenged the ability of women to access contraception under President Obama's health care reform law. The controversy first erupted after the president issued a ruling mandating that employers, with the exception of churches themselves, provide free contraceptives to their female employees. Because Catholic institutions that serve the public, such as hospitals and universities, were included, Catholic bishops objected, causing the president to offer a compromise that shifted the responsibility to offer contraceptives to insurance companies. While public opinion polls found wide support for Mr. Obama's position, a Republican bill now making its way through Congress would allow any employer to withdraw insurance coverage for any medical procedure or treatment that they had a moral objection to. The introduction of legislation in Virginia that would force women seeking abortions to undergo medically unnecessary transvaginal ultrasounds sparked widespread protest and attention to the Republican Party's allegiance to the agenda of the radical Christian right. Your reporter spoke with Peter Montgomery, senior fellow with the group People for the American Way, who talks about some reasons behind the revival of Christian right culture war issues in the 2012 presidential election campaign.
Well, I think there's a couple of things going on. One, I think that the economic news has in some ways been getting better for the country in terms of, you know, numbers about job creation and unemployment and consumer confidence and business confidence. So for, you know, the Republican candidates who thought that they were going to cruise through on the basis of hard economic times are a little worried that that might not stand them through November. And so I think that's partly why we're getting this increased focus on, you know, social issues and, you know, this bogus claim that the Obama administration is engaged in a war on religion or a war on religious liberty. You know, that's the kind of rhetoric we're used to seeing from, you know, the fringes of the religious right, and now we're hearing it from presidential candidates and bishops and all kinds of folks.
Is the message we're hearing from any of these candidates as they bring up abortion, contraception, the so-called Obama administration's war on religion, is that having any resonance with the American public at large? Or is the rhetoric from the GOP candidates really targeted at a very narrow spectrum of voters who will be casting ballots in the Republican primaries alone?
Well, I think there's two different things going on here. I think that you're right that in the Republican primaries, you know, what's happening is that all the candidates seem to be competing to see who can prove themselves to be furthest to the right in order to energize those conservative voters who make up the bulk of the Republican Party base and the people who are most likely to go vote in the primaries. And so, you know, we have Santorum as well as Gingrich and Romney, you know, accusing Obama of waging a war on religious liberty. And Santorum is sort of the most out there with his rhetoric, you know, and his comment this weekend that John F. Kennedy's speech on separation of church and state made him want to throw up. It's just kind of the most colorful of his rhetoric. So I think that's what's going on for the Republican primary. And then I think in the big picture, people like the Catholic bishops and the National Organization for Marriage, who have been really upset about the advance of marriage equality in the country and gay rights generally, and they have been trying to portray gay rights and religious liberty as somehow inherently in conflict. And I think that's partly because they're losing the war of public opinion when it comes to LGBT equality. Most Americans support equality for gay people, and younger Americans overwhelmingly do so. And I think they're trying to change the conversation and make it a conversation about something that Americans also value, which is religious liberty. And that's why we've also seen them try to turn their criticism of the Obama administration's health care and regulations on contraception into claims that the administration is hostile to religious liberty. I think it's just an effort to use rhetoric that taps into a value most Americans do have, which is supporting religious liberty. I just think it's not accurate and it's misleading.
I wanted to talk to you about the changing demographics in the country. And if you think the Republican Party's employment of culture war issues will be successful this time around in the 2012 campaign, as it was for George W. Bush and his advisor Karl Rove in both the 2000 and 2004 elections, where they used guns, gods, and gays as their basic strategy to make sure that their voters, their base of Christian right and conservative voters, came out to the polls in the presidential elections in those years. What kind of luck do you think they'll have with those issues this time around?
You know, I don't really think it's going to work. They certainly have a chunk of their base voters that they can motivate with that, and they may do that and try to turn people out. But if you look at the broader electorate and including, you know, independent voters who are really keys to winning the election, opinions are changing a lot. You know, even on, just for example, on the issue of equality for LGBT people and equality for same-sex couples, it's really dramatic changes of public opinion in the last 10 years, in the last 20 years. And so, you know, the kind of strident anti-gay rhetoric that we're seeing may appeal to and energize a big chunk of the Republican Party base, but it's not the way you're going to win over independent voters or the majority of the public. And so I think they're playing a losing game in that regard. And again, it gets back to that conundrum of the party itself having moved so far to the right and the sort of core activists of the party sort of having embraced this no compromise ideology requires people running for office to go so far right in the primary that I think they're going to damage their general election prospects.
That was Peter Montgomery, senior fellow with People for the American Way. Visit our...
On the 29th of February, Occupy activists all over the United States launched a series of coordinated strikes against corporations involved with ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. ALEC ghostwrites legislation for politicians to benefit large corporations. Big corporations write the legislation, ALEC hands it off to politicians, the politicians then claim it as their own. One of the most infamous examples was Arizona's racist SB 1070, which is almost a carbon copy of an ALEC model law concerning no sanctuary cities for immigrants. Just to show you how far to the right ALEC really is, the neo-Nazis also had a hand in writing SB 1070 and therefore presumably in ALEC's model law as well. In addition to the Nazis, we're dealing with corporations like Monsanto, which relies on ALEC to write pro-GMO, anti-farmer, pro-intellectual property and seed patent legislation to benefit their corporate interests. On the 29th of February, Occupy activists in D.C. marched on Monsanto and blockaded their headquarters. Before they did, they stopped at the headquarters of ALEC itself, and one of the Occupy activists read out this speech about what's wrong with ALEC.
This is ALEC!
This is ALEC! Without disclosing
that corporations
crafted sat and voted on the bills.
Sat and voted on the bills.
Alec boasts.
Alec boasts.
That it has over 1,000 of these bills.
That it has over 1,000 of these bills.
Introduced by legislative members.
Introduced by legislative members.
Every year.
Every year.
With one in every five.
With one in every five.
Enacted into law.
Enacted into law.
The voting public.
The voting public.
Has no representation.
Has no representation.
The corporations.
The corporations.
Steal our democracy.
Steal our democracy.
And write their own laws.
To write their own laws.
Among state governors.
Among state governors.
In collusion with Alec.
In collusion with Alec.
Are Arizona's Jan Brewer.
Arizona's Jan Brewer.
Who fought for and signed
the most racist
immigration and profiling laws in the nation.
Immigration and profiling laws in the nation.
Wisconsin's
Scott Walker,
whose attempt to crush public employees' right to organize.
Public employees' right to organize.
Spark the occupation movement
with a month-long occupation of our state's capital
in Ohio's John Cage
who followed Walker's infamy
in his own state. Check online at alecexposed.org.
Check online at alecexposed.org.
To find your state's corruption by Alec.
To find your state's corruption by Alec.
On the 29th of February, Occupy DC activists blockaded the DC headquarters of Monsanto. Monsanto was a member of Alec, the notorious right-wing outfit that helps corporations like Monsanto write their own regulatory and other legislation. In the case of Monsanto, that means legislation to allow the sale of their genetically engineered frankenfood. It also means trade treaties and legislation favorable to lawsuits against farmers over their despicable practice of patenting seeds. After stopping at Alec's headquarters, Occupy DC arrived at Monsanto's ISP headquarters just before 8 a.m., rolling up with carts carrying boards to block the doors.
Swarming in on it.
Everybody, quick, run. We gotta do it.
Come on.
Rolling in on Monsanto. Full speed charge. There's a lot to stop up.
It's got to go!
Yeah! The police tried but failed to keep Occupy from deploying boards blocking the doors. At one door, two whole lines of beautifully painted doors were in place blocking the doors by 8 a.m. Finally managed to push away the boards, a second layer of blockades remained in place. Arm-locked protesters again blocking the doors. One of the four sets of doors was soon cleared of blockaders, only to reveal a chain lock left in the doors themselves. The blockade lasted over an hour and a half,
It wasn't until 9:30 a.m. that Monsanto was able to open their doors for business. 12 people were arrested, 10 at the blockades, but two more for trying to take a survey of cops about police brutality. Man, that is ugly.
Hey, hey,
hey, hey, here we go.
What is wrong with you?
Why are you fucking?
What is wrong with you?
Why was he grabbing her?
What is wrong with you?
What is your problem?
De-arrested!
Arrest that officer for grabbing.
Don't let him close up. Use me for cover. Use me for cover.
No!
Whoa, I'm hung up on a damn tree.
Hey guys, be careful there.
Yeah, they call me in a goddamn tree. One cop, Officer Freeman, badge number 18, was pushing women around all day, far more than men. I guess that gives new meaning to copping a feel. Copping a feel or not, those cops weren't able to keep Occupy DC from shutting down Monsanto for over an hour on the National Shut Down the Corporations Day. You might have heard of the term predatory lending. Usually when we think of predatory loans, we think of payday lenders, car title loans, and the predatory mortgage lending that helped cause the Depression. But there was another form of predatory lending, predatory student loans. Very high tuition that you see at private colleges is being paid for largely with loans that students are encouraged to take out. College recruiters go to students and they say, "You're going to make so much money after you graduate, you won't have any trouble at all paying off $40,000, even $80,000 in student loans." But guess what? That's a crapshoot. Sometimes the jobs don't materialize. Sometimes the economy goes bust. Sometimes the training is obsolete before you can even finish school. Millions of students all over the United States are finding they can't pay their student loans. They can't discharge them through bankruptcy. All those promises that came from Sally Mae and all those promises that came from those bullshitting college recruiters were nothing but lies, and here they are with debt that can't be paid. These kind of student loans are predatory debt, so on the 1st of March, Occupy DC and Occupy students marched on the Department of Education and on Sally Mae with two main demands: 100% public funding of tuition, and the cancellation of all existing student debt, as one of their signs said has been done in Barcelona, Spain.
My name is Seth Ray. I started OccupyStudentDebt.com to collect stories from millions of Americans who are suffering from the burden of student debt, who go without health care, without retirement, and without homes, sometimes even food, to pay off these bills that they can never discharge in bankruptcy. Sally Mae, over the past decade, has spent millions of dollars lobbying Congress to strip away vital consumer protections and refinancing rights, to categorize student debt differently from all different types of debt. You can't even discharge student debt in bankruptcy if you're 100% disabled and unable to work, because thanks to the laws, they can garnish your disability. It doesn't matter if you have MS, it doesn't matter if you're self-care, it doesn't even matter if you're dead. They'll just go after your next of kin. I want to talk about my story for a bit. I was here 3 weeks ago. I signed a petition in October calling for Sally Mae to end their unemployment penalty fee. If you can't pay your Sally Mae loans, if you graduate and you're unemployed, underemployed, if your waitressing can't make ends meet, you have to pay $50 per loan for 3 month box of forbearance to prove that you can't pay. For me, because I have three loans and Sally Mae took away the option of consolidation in 2008, I have to pay $150 every 3 months just to prove that I can't pay. Meanwhile, thanks to my crazy interest rate of nearly 10%, my total debt still grows every 3 months by $1,100. So Sally Mae double dips. Prior to my petition, which currently has 150,000 signatures, this money did not whatsoever. Sallie Mae's PR crew referred to it as a good faith deposit, but that's bullshit because a deposit is something that comes back to you. And now they've changed because of the partial victory. When I was here 3 weeks ago and I dropped off a box of 76,000 signatures, they decided to change it so that they'll only apply this money to your total balance if you make 6 months of consecutive steady on-time payments after the forbearance begins. So basically, they're going to hold your money in limbo, possibly make money off of interest. And they'll, if you make 1 day late in payment because you're temping, waitressing, or freelancing, and you can't pay on time every single month, then that money just goes straight back to them. And regardless, it's still a fee that I can't pay and that many unemployed graduates cannot pay. The reason I am here today, the reason why I have Sallie Mae loans, is because my parents passed away by the time I was 12. I was always told that education would be the way out of poverty. I grew up on food stamps. I grew up humiliated by the sting of poverty, and I was always told that education would be my way out, my way into the middle class. My financial aid office did not differentiate between federal and private loans, and they steered me directly towards Sallie Mae with their posters of happy, smiling college students sponsored by Sallie Mae all over their walls of the office. I started college when I was 16. I've always had very high grades. I've always worked full-time while going to school, but I still needed money for rent, utilities, and groceries. I did not live lavishly. When I was in college, I lived in the fifth floor of a walk-up next to a power plant, but I persevered because I believed that this would be the way out. I've been unemployed since graduation. I've been turned down for jobs cleaning toilets at a motel because I'm overqualified. I nearly joined the military, but thanks to the fact that my petition blew up, I'm very grateful that things have since turned around. But there's millions of Americans whose stories I've seen on OccupyStudentDebt.com who are still suffering. And you know what? The media keeps talking about, oh, well, this generation, they don't want to move out of their parents' homes. They don't want real jobs because they've watched too many Seth Rogen movies. Bullshit. Our American dream has been deferred. If you default on a student loan, you'll never be able to buy a home, rent an apartment, or even get a job with 60% of employers that check credit. And Sallie Mae has rigged the system to profit from defaults. With the lack of bankruptcy protection, if you default, they will get that money no matter what. It's time for us to fight back and restore the these consumer protections. Any form of income-based repayment. They won't negotiate on monthly payments or interest rates at all. And these media stories focus on the sob story aspect. They'll say, oh, look, this is such a sad situation. Poor little orphan girl, her parents are dead. You know, it's a cautionary tale for the class of 2019, but let's not focus on them. Let's focus on who's drowning now.
Yeah.
We need to fix this now. We need to restore these protections now. Even if you have credit card debt, the banks will work with you to lower your monthly payment according to your household budget. Sallie Mae will not negotiate monthly payments, interest rates, or offer any income-based repayment, like I said. The only lower payment option is interest only, and that will not put dent in your total debt. I took out $40,000 in my undergrad. Since then, within the matter of 2 years since earning my BA, it's ballooned to $65,000. I know how interest works, but this is usury. Plain and simple.
Economic slavery.
It is economic slavery. So we're here, Sallie Mae. It's time for you to listen. I'm not going anywhere. I was here 3 weeks ago. I've got an army of 150,000 people standing with me. I'm not going to forget because you have ruined my financial future. All I fucking want is to be able to buy a fucking house one day. And I don't have parents to move back home to. I need to be able to rent a fucking apartment in my name.
We're with you, girl.
I worked my ass off. Don't you dare call me lazy or entitled. Yeah. Just because I want survival!
Yeah.
Woo! Right.
So we're here, Sallie Mae, and we're bringing you Sallie Mayhem.
The drive in Arizona to send more inmates to private prisons is costing taxpayer money and making prisons more difficult to monitor, concludes a new report by the American Friends Service Committee. Between 2008 and 2010, Arizona taxpayers paid $10 million more for private prison beds than it would have cost to house inmates in state prisons. Arizona is planning to send an additional 2,000 more inmates to private prisons owned by the Corrections Corporation of America and the GEO Group at a cost of $38 million. Prison reform groups also question the level of safety inside privately run prisons. In the past 3 years, Arizona has had 28 prison riots and 2,000 violent incidents involving 50 inmates or more. Most of these incidents were not disclosed to the public. Inexperienced prison staff may have led to a riot at the privately run Kingman Prison in 2010, where a witness said guards did nothing to stop a large group of white inmates from attacking black prisoners. Phoenix Democratic State Representative Chad Campbell has filed several bills to monitor private prisons, but none of the proposals are expected to receive a public hearing in the Republican-controlled Arizona State Legislature.
GEO Group is a private prison corporation, the second largest in the world. Among other things, they run Rivers Correctional Institution, where many inmates from Washington, D.C. have been sent. Wells Fargo is being boycotted by many D.C. residents because Wells Fargo took their bailout money to buy a large stake in GEO Group. On the 24th of February, Anonymous and Antisec hacked the GEO Group's website, replacing the normal website with a rap video featuring a photograph of Mumia Abu-Jamal, who was formerly on death row, and carrying this communique: wiped off the net. Welcome again to another round of attacks on our most favorite days. Fuck FBIF Friday. I hope you got a quick laugh out of that Dayton, Ohio InfraGuard defacement earlier. But rest easy, fellow pirates. More mayhem is on the way. As part of our ongoing efforts to dismantle the prison industrial complex, we attacked one of the largest private prison corporations in the U.S., GEO Group. Despite the well-documented history of corruption, scandal, and atrocities that companies like GEO perpetuate each and every minute our friends are locked behind our prison walls, the private prison industry is still booming. While most folks are suffering under the economy, many billions of dollars are being funneled into the sinister, conniving alliance of capitalist and statist forces to try to build dozens and dozens of new prisons around the world. What they did not figure into their plans was a determined effort to shut them down. What they did not expect is that Anonymous has been lurking their shitty Windows V-host for months and finally pulled the trigger. You mad? We are acting in solidarity with all those who have ever been wrongfully profiled, arrested, brutalized, incarcerated, and have had all dignity and humanity stripped from them as they are cast into the gulags of America. On February 28th, our fellow Anons and Occupiers will be marching in the streets of the U.S. to demand an end to the suppression of the occupation movement. But our solidarity does not extend only to occupiers or political prisoners. We do not give any legitimacy or credibility to a justice system that looks after their own prosecutors and pigs who get away with brutality and corruption while they routinely murder innocent people on death row and lock up immigrants they deem, quote, illegal, while profiting by forcing them to do labor for less than minimum wage. When our comrades are locked up struggling against a repressive regime that has no concern for due process, we do not forget. When our comrades are ripped off their civil liberties and human liberties, we do not forgive. We will abolish their prisons in all forms and run the pigs off our streets. We will burn down their prison society, because only on the ashes of the old world can we hope to rebuild a new one. Solidarity means attack! Against the backdrop of a global uprising that is simmering in dozens of countries and thousands of cities and towns, the G8 and NATO will hold a rare simultaneous summit in Chicago this May. The world's military and political elites, heads of state, 7,500 officials from 80 nations, and more than 2,500 journalists will be there. And so will we. On the 1st of May, 50,000 people from all over the world will flock to Chicago, set up tents, kitchens, peaceful barricades, and occupy Chicago for a month. With a bit of luck,
will pull off the biggest multinational occupation of a summit meeting the world has ever seen. This time, we're not going to put up with the kind of police repression that happened during the Democratic National Convention protest in Chicago 1968, nor will we abide by any phony restrictions the city of Chicago may want to impose on our First Amendment rights. We'll go there with our heads held high and assemble for a month-long people's summit. We'll march and chant and sing and shout and exercise our right to tell our elected representatives what we want. The Constitution will be our guide. When the G8 and NATO meet behind closed doors on May 19th, we'll be ready with our demands: a Robin Hood tax, a ban on high-frequency flash trading, a binding climate change accord, a three strikes and you're outlaw for corporate criminals, an all-out initiative for a nuclear-free Middle East. Whatever we decide in our general assemblies and in our global internet brainstorm, we the people will set the agenda for the next few years and demand our leaders carry it out. And if they don't listen, if they ignore us and put our demands on the back burner like they've done so many times before, then, with Gandhian ferocity, we'll flash mob the streets, shut down stock exchanges, campuses, corporate headquarters, and cities across the globe. We'll make the price of doing business as usual too much to bear. Jammers, pack your tents, muster up your courage, and prepare for a big bang in Chicago this spring. If we don't stand up now and fight now for a different kind of future, we may not have much of a future. So let's live without dead time for a month in May and see what happens. For the Wild Culture Jammers Headquarters.
Southern Ocean. Today, the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society ship Bob Barker has caught the Japanese whaling factory ship Nishan Maru and shut her down. The illegal poaching fleet was caught at 64 degrees 59 minutes south and 130 degrees 51 minutes east, which is at Commonwealth Bay, 60 miles off the Antarctic coast, inside the Australian Economic Exclusion Zone. This came after a late February fake refueling stop by the Steve Irwin, supposedly to refuel the Bob Barker, left two of the three Harpoon ships and a security ship showing Maru number 2 well over 1,000 miles away with nobody covering the Bob Barker. As a result, Bob Barker was able to reach the Nishan Maru and the one remaining Harpoon ship just slightly behind the other two Harpoon ships. All three Harpoon ships tried and failed to stop the Bob Barker, which is now chasing the fleeing Nishan Maru, which cannot escape because the Bob Barker is faster and cannot slow down the whale, because the Bob Barker would then have complete freedom of action. The season is nearly over, and for all but a few days, only one instead of three of the Harpoon ships was anywhere near the factory ship, thanks to Sea Shepherd's drones and the early season evasion of the Shonan Maru, forcing the use of two of the three Harpoon ships to chase Sea Shepherd ships instead of whales. When the Nishan Maru returns to port, it is a near certainty that they will again have killed far fewer whales than their self-imposed quota of 900, and again absorb a severe economic loss thanks to Sea Shepherd's courageous direct action.